This is a big port in Europe. You know, guys are coming ashore after relatively long voyages, and they would like a little fun and a little respite. And of course, there were people around to provide it. But there were also streets which were famous for not quite brothels, but houses of ill repute, let's say. And when new churches were built, sometimes there was the idea that a bit of the city could be cleaned up. But usually, for some reason, people found it really convenient to build the occasional house of ill repute on the way between two churches. It might tell us something about the people.
History isn't just a bunch of names and dates and facts. It's the collection of all the stories throughout human history that explain how and why we got here. Welcome to the History Unplugged podcast, where we look at the forgotten, neglected, strange, and even counterfactual stories that made our world what it is. I'm your host, Scott Rank. In the 21st century, the best-known city of vice is Las Vegas. You might throw Amsterdam in the mix. But if you had to guess what that would be in the 16th century, most wouldn't get it right. Well, it's the city of Antwerp, Belgium. Very few non-Europeans could place it on the map, and not that many people would even know it's in Belgium. But for half of the 16th century, it was the place for breaking rules, whether they're religious, sexual, or intellectual. It was described by some as Europe's Babylon, and the city arguably had an outsized role in creating the modern world. During this period, which was the early part of the Age of Exploration, when wealth from the New World, India, and China was flowing into Europe, Antwerp was sort of like a 19th century Paris or 20th century New York. It was a place where just about anything could happen, where the finance market exploded, and you can engage in almost any sort of vice and heresy that you wanted to. And it was also a place of change. A single man cornered all the money in the city and reinvented ideas of what money meant. Today, when you think of a piece of artwork and you price it in dollars in your head, this largely comes from Antwerp, where goods were commoditized. Jews fleeing the Portuguese Inquisition needed Antwerp for their escape, thanks to a remarkable woman at the head of the grandest banking family in Europe. She set up an underground railroad for Jews so they could flee persecution and find safe passage to friendlier lands like Poland or the Ottoman Empire. Antwerp is a surprising setting for lots of other things. Thomas More opened Utopia here. Erasmus puzzled over money and exchanges, and William Tyndale sheltered there and smuggled out his English language Bible until he was eventually killed. But when Antwerp rebelled with the Dutch against the Spanish and lost, this history was largely forgotten. That's because troops burned the city records trying to erase its history. To discuss the growth and decline of the city is today's guest, Michael Pye, author of Europe's Babylon, The Rise and Fall of Antwerp's Golden Age. There were many unexpected things that created the modern world, and this city was one of them. So I hope you enjoy. Michael, welcome to the show.
Very good to be here, Scott.
Well, histories like yours, I think, are interesting because part of what they do is take our conception of something modern, and in your case, it's the city of Antwerp, and show that historically it is completely the opposite of what it is today. Now, most of my listeners, according to my analytics, are in the United States. And they simply don't even have an impression of the city of Antwerp. Some might have an impression of the nation of Belgium, but it would begin or end with Belgian ales, Belgian waffles or fries, and Jean-Claude Van Damme. So we do not have a strong foundation to build upon. But could you enlighten my audience, if someone were to know the stereotypes of the city of Antwerp, what would those modern stereotypes be?
Well, the modern ones are really rather nasty. They're very nasty right-wing politics. More cocaine in the sewage system than any other city in Europe. So the Economist says, so it must be right. Frocks and fashion. And of course, the second biggest port in Europe. It still is. It's incredibly important. And yet, any time that I said to people at dinner parties, I'm writing a book about Antwerp, there would be a long pause followed by, why? And I would have to explain. I mean, there is Antwerp the city, but there's also Antwerp in the 16th century, the first half of the 16th century, which is not just a city, it's a phenomenon. It was a city that its contemporaries said was the hub of the world, the Emporium Mundi, which I suppose roughly translates as the department store of the world. It was a place through which all of the new things that were coming to Europe from India, from Africa, from America. Through Antwerp, they all flowed. And it becomes this incredible nexus of knowledge, of inquiry, of trade, of business, of crime, of spies, and occasionally murders as well. It becomes, in fact, a story that needs to be told. The complication in telling it is that, unfortunately, due to the failure of the Spanish monarch who controlled the Netherlands at the time to either pay or indeed feed his troops in Antwerp, they became rebellious, they broke out of their garrison, they burnt the town, and in burning the town, they burnt the town hall and much of the city's records. So it's a tricky story to put together. There aren't the usual solid batches of documents. You have to go around the world to see what the world thought of Antwerp.
I mean, it sounds like, before getting into the story proper, that had the record survived and there hadn't been this revisionist push, Antwerp could have been there with the Italian city-states or Venice or other hubs of power that were also intellectual centers too. I mean, do you think that's a fair assessment?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, Venice watched Antwerp really carefully. One of my basic sources is the reports of the Venetian ambassadors. Venice wanted to know exactly what was happening, what trade was happening, what ideas were going around, how heretical Antwerp has managed to become. No, it the great horror of Antwerp, in a way, is that having managed for half of the 16th century to keep the wars of the Reformation out of its streets, suddenly they came in. They came in with iconoclasm, they came in with Spanish troops tramping down the streets. They could no longer avoid this. And when it could not be avoided, the extraordinary thing that Antwerp had been was at an end. But was it? Because in a curious sort of way, Antwerp went north. Antwerp is the source of so much that became the golden age of Amsterdam. I mean, all sorts of things, not population for a start. When the Spanish took back Antwerp, which had managed to be a sort of independent republic for 10 minutes in 1585, they said that the Protestant population could leave, and one third of the population of Antwerp left. Many of them went north, went to Amsterdam. They were the core of the population of Amsterdam that made the Golden Age. And come to that, I mean, the idea of deliberately building a city around canals, not just because you're building it on islands, because you're building the canals, comes from Antwerp. That's how the new town of Antwerp was built. That's how Amsterdam was built later.
Well, the action in your book is during the 16th century, and I've noticed historians love to camp out. There's a couple of centuries that are very popular. One is the 16th century, and the other is the 19th century. And there's others as well, but what makes these such good objects of study and also for popular consumption is that you see so much change happening at once. The groundwork that's being built for the Renaissance and the early modern period and the shift away from the medieval world, I mean, that's already being planted in the 13th and 14th and 15th centuries. There are new technologies. There are classics being translated. But you really see the breakout and the changes coming to the surface at this time. But right on the eve of the change, could you describe to me what was happening in Antwerp? Because you note that this is a city learning how to be a power in its own right as it emerges from feudalism, but it's still haunted in the early modern period by plague, fires, violence. So what was medieval Antwerp on the eve of all this change, just so we can understand the change that does happen in context?
Well, it was a place that absolutely stank. It was possibly the most filthy smelling kind of town. Like many medieval and early modern towns, it was a place where the canals were foully polluted, where people threw out the rare rubbish, including the blood from the surgeons, onto the street. I mean, this is not a pretty place. It's also an incredibly busy place. Every street becomes a market at some time of day. You can walk down a street and suddenly, oh, I don't know, you'll find that a shopkeeper pops up at your feet because people were digging down to make cellars to store things. They were building jetties over the streets to store things. And those jetties got so tight over the street that the city council complained that people couldn't actually get a cart through any longer. So you've got something that's congested, stinking. It goes on fire from time to time. Even the great cathedral went on fire. It's full of plague. If Antwerp hadn't had massive immigration, if it hadn't been really attractive, it would have got smaller and smaller through the century. Such was the toll of plague. So this is not, we're not talking about an agreeable place to be, but we're talking in many ways about a wonderful place to be. everything was up for grabs. The stuff that was coming in across the docks in Antwerp is the discoveries, the new drugs that are coming from India or America, the ideas that are coming from across the world. And all of these things make a great boiling. To me, it's fascinating because it's a time when everything is up for grabs. Everything can be changed. And you can watch as people try to work out how they can change it.
What were the triggers that caused this change to happen? I mean, there are a lot of things happening in the late 15th, early 16th century, not only the discovery of the New World, but the expulsion of Jews out of Iberia, which is a population shift, but also with them comes changes in finance, changes in trade networks. So what happens in Antwerp? Is it a convergence of these factors? Is it one thing? How does this change come about?
Well, more than anything else, it's the fact that all of a sudden the trade routes that matter are going across oceans. They're not coming up the Red Sea and across the Mediterranean. So Venice is all of a sudden not in a very good position. I mean, in order to get to Venice, you've got to get through rather nasty groups of pirates around Gibraltar, and you've then got to get yourself to Venice. No, Antwerp has the advantage of being on the North Sea, which is a huge advantage for easy access from around the world, and also in the estuary, close to the estuary of the Rhine, which means that there's a big river which you can go up into the heart of Europe, right up to the Alps and cross the Alps into Italy. So what you've got is a place which was designed to be connected. You've then got a place whose main rival was Bruges. Now, Bruges had a problem, and that was mud. Bruges' connections with the sea were silting up, whereas Antwerp has a deep tidal river that scours itself. It keeps the passageways open, as it were. That's an extraordinary thing. When you then get the fact that Antwerp, and this is important, but such a detail that it's easy to forget, at the time, there were two distinct areas within the Spanish Netherlands, Flanders, the word we still use, and Brabant, the word that we use less and less. This matters because Flanders had a lot of manufacturers. Brabant didn't, and Antwerp is in Brabant. Because it didn't have manufacturers on the same scale, it didn't have the same protections for workers and craftsmen and businesses, and the guilds were less strong. So Antwerp, in a way, was in this extraordinary position. All of a sudden, it was a dominant port on that coast. All of a sudden, that coast was the coast that mattered for getting the riches of the world into Europe. And it was much less regulated. I'm not doing a sort of sermon about limited government. No, not at all. Because, in fact, Antwerp limited its government so much it couldn't run anything. But the real point is that it did have a degree of flexibility. And it did one thing which is probably more important than any other. It had two annual fairs. And during those trade fairs, anything virtually went. Antwerp, unlike other ports, didn't say, if you're going to bring things into our docks, you have to unpack them. You have to be doing something with them here. No, Antwerp allowed goods to be brought in, and then people did deals. The goods were not for Antwerp to eat or drink or put on their backs. The goods were there for Antwerp to make deals. So it suddenly becomes a place where money becomes almost an abstraction, and thinking in terms of money is an abstract way of thinking. Now, that's a change of mind. That's a huge change of mind.
Now, I'd like to really dig into this, because this is interesting, where what you're saying is this isn't a sermon about deregulation, but there's a whole spectrum of lack of regulation. And in Antwerp's case, it doesn't have a bishop, it doesn't have a ruling dynasty, it doesn't have a court. Now, if there's in the modern world, I don't know if I would call it well-regulated anarchy, but there's maybe well-regulated deregulation, a Switzerland or Luxembourg, where these could be tax havens or other places where people can park their money and they know it's well protected, but also the bookkeepers will look the other way in a way they won't in other places. Now, if you have total deregulation, then you have a Somalia where it's simply chaos and the vacuum of power is filled by a warlord. Then people will not park their investments. So how did Antwerp operate successfully in what otherwise could have been total dysfunction?
Well, it had one very simple advantage. In theory, Antwerp obviously answered to the Habsburg Emperor in Madrid. in theory, Charles V ruled Antwerp. In another way, Antwerp ruled Charles V because he needed money all the time for his style of life and for the fighting of one war after another. So he couldn't interfere too much with the magic, as it were, of Antwerp. And what Antwerp did, almost accidentally, it now looks like a tolerant city. It wasn't quite. It was a city which welcomed heretics from all over in order that it could be this hub of world trade and do the deals from which the money could be made. And with all of those heretics in place, you have a city which, first of all, is boiling with ideas and printing ideas and publishing ideas and getting them out to the whole of Europe and the rest of the world. But you also have a place which connects things that otherwise might not be connected. And that, I think, is the fascination about Antwerp. It looks so small on the map. It's a city we've almost forgotten. But at this period, it's a place where the connections were made. And those connections produced ideas and also money.
Hey, everyone. Scott here. We're going to take a very short break for a word from our sponsors. Can you talk about some of those connections and what the result of those were?
Well, for a start, the business of dealing with the Far East, with China in particular, brought in all sorts of new and exciting medicines. I mean, there was a wonderful root, Smilax, which was supposed to cure syphilis and was going to therefore solve all the problems that were coming in from America at the time. You can have a root that lands on your docks, but you have to know what to do with it. You have to have, as it were, the theory to go with the goods. And that was Antwerp's strength. Ideas came across the docks as well. So in the case of Smilax, people knew that you couldn't eat this and you couldn't eat that, and you'd probably better go to bed for a bit while you were taking Smilax, and all of these exciting things. But the point is, there was a theory to go with the route. And the two things went together in Antwerp. Probably the most important connection Antwerp made was between the goods coming in and what on earth could be done with them.
What are some modern analogs, whether it's cities or industries, that you've used to compare this? Because as I'm thinking about these new products that come, on the positive side, I mean, it could be scientific development. On the negative side, it could be, let's say, the unregulated supplement market and pseudoscience, where this supplement is guaranteed to increase your workout and burn calories 300% faster. But really, it's basically a bunch of inactive ingredients and caffeine, and it's a protein powder that sells for $200, but it does nothing that a cup of coffee wouldn't do. Are there modern-day cities or industries that you maybe would compare this to as this is developing?
Not now. Not now that we've got the internet. Not now that we've got instant worldwide connections. Because we don't need a single place to make those connections anymore. You know, you can make them in a podcast studio. You can make them anywhere. Just as I'm talking from Amsterdam and you're not, but we're still talking. That seems to me to matter enormously. This was a period when physical connections, actually being where these things were happening, really mattered. And people did indeed go to Antwerp for this. They went to Antwerp for opportunities, as it were, chances to make money. One wonderful man went in order to launch a ship to take pilgrims to the Holy Land, offering half fare for anybody who did not come back alive, which I think is one of the better deals for a cruise ship. The desire to buy and sell and the ability to buy and sell depends on having, first of all, of course, people who are selling, but also buyers. And Antwerp's glory was that it had such a mix of people from all over Europe that they were demanding one thing after another. The marketing pictures in Antwerp, which begins 100 years before the marketing pictures in Amsterdam, is being fueled by Italian merchants who want pictures, by German merchants who want pictures. This is a place where things do connect.
Well, another thing too is I'm curious about the innovations, but then also the legacy of finance within Antwerp, because you note that in the city, there's a single man who cornered all the money and reinvented ideas of what money meant. So, number one, I'm curious about that. Number two, with the Jewish population that had been expelled from Iberia, Portugal specifically, Jews as money lenders in the medieval world were very important because there was all sorts of church canon law and regulation about charging interest on money due to different types of scriptural interpretations. These prohibitions didn't apply to the Jewish population, and they were also barred from a lot of other professions, so many of them found their way into finance. And this leads to all sorts of tropes and anti-Semitic stereotypes later. But when money needed to be raised or accessed, they were very important to medieval society and later. So can you tell me about this convergence and the financial industry in Antwerp?
Okay, let's talk about it from two different angles. Let's talk about it, first of all, about the most extraordinary woman, Donna Gracia, who was the head of the largest merchant banking operation in Europe in her own right. I mean, this is a woman whose husband had died and left her half the House of Mendes, their firm, a family firm. But then his brother died and left the other half of the House of Mendes to her, a woman in whom the people who best knew both her and the business had absolute confidence. Now, they're in Antwerp for a fairly simple reason. The Portuguese were making what money they did make, the Portuguese crown was always nearly bust, out of the spice trade to India. And the spice trade went very much through Antwerp for distribution in Europe. So the Mendes brothers had set up in Antwerp, and that is where their headquarters were. But at the same time, the elder Mendes brother was back in Lisbon lending money to the Portuguese crown. So you have somebody who's tangled with both, again, a connection, who's tangled both with the Portuguese and what they want, which is to make the spice trade make money, and Antwerp and what it wants, which is as much business going through as will make sense and will make money. The Jewish element is extraordinary because Antwerp became very important to Jews who were trying to get out of Portugal. As you know, when Isabel of Spain throws the Jews out of Spain, they first cross the border into Portugal, and they're given a certain amount of protection for a very few years, after which, unfortunately, the King of Portugal decides to marry the daughter of the King and Queen of Spain, and Spanish attitudes come crashing across the border. But things got even worse than the massacres in Lisbon in the 1500s. They got worse because the Inquisition was coming in, because the most Catholic king of Portugal really wanted the Inquisition in to rout out new Christians, the forcibly converted Christians, who were actually practicing Jews. And when that happened, you have a nightmare. All of a sudden, you have people who have been enormously successful in supporting the Portuguese crown, being told by the Portuguese crown, no, you can't leave. And what's more, if you do try to leave, you can't take anything with you. You are trapped in the place which is hostile to you. But when you get that sort of situation, you have real emergency, and you've got to find a way, a scheme, to get those people out. And Donna Gracia was not just head of the biggest merchant banking house in Europe. She was one of the organizers of the most extraordinary sort of underground railway committee that got people out of Portugal, which was difficult enough. You know, you had to get them onto the right ship at the right moment. They had not to be noticed. Got them to London or to England, actually usually Southampton. And there they waited for a little bit to see how the winds were blowing in Antwerp. And then if the Emperor Charles V, who was very much against heresy in any form, was in a goodish sort of mood, to Antwerp. And in Antwerp, the money could be organized, the letters of credit could be organized, suddenly fortunes could be made portable so you could carry them to the next places you were going. And through Donna Gracia, there was an organization which laid down what time of day you should leave Antwerp, what inn you should stay in Cologne, and then right down to don't wear anything fancy because people will just charge you more for everything. Don't lose your passports under any circumstances. And by the way, if you're traveling with your wife and you're crossing the Alps, make sure that the horses you're riding come from the same stable because horses like to ride in a family just like you do. All of this was organized and laid down from Antwerp. Yet it was a place where Jews didn't stay all that long. It was Donna Gracia herself left earlier than you might expect because the emperor was trying to marry off her daughter to a rather ramshackle wreck of an old aristocrat with the idea of keeping the Mendes money firmly within the empire. It was a place to go through. That's the point of Antwerp. It was a place not necessarily to settle in, but to use for the fact that it was connected, just as you could cash the letters of credit coming from Portugal and also use them to create an escape route right across the Alps into Italy and then on to Istanbul. So that is the extraordinary story of Jewish Antwerp. It is, by the way, a little bit early for Jewish Antwerp to be the Diamond Princess, which I guess is what people mostly associate with Antwerp now. But diamonds were coming in, and Jews certainly were doing business. And it was a place where it was possible to imagine new things. The other side is the settled side. And the settled side deals with the law and order, with the official powers, with the emperor and with all the people who work for or to the emperor, including his governors in the Spanish Netherlands. Now, they're a very different story. And Antwerp has, again, an important role in this. Antwerp protected the Jewish population in a way, and it protected it not by being bombastic, but by making fun of the emperor in a way. So the emperor really has gone going into one of his fits of absolute fury about heretics in the empire, and sends a commissioner to rout out the new Christians in Antwerp. Oh, fine, good idea. The unfortunate commissioner arrives at 6 o'clock in the evening and is told that, well, unfortunately, the Margrave, the local noble leader, can't actually see you because he's got a fever. Is he likely to get better? Well, he might be better tomorrow morning. Well, can we see him, please, at 6 o'clock? Well, I don't know, 6 o'clock, 6:30, perhaps a little bit later. And this process goes on and on and on. Endless niggling to stop anybody actually being arrested or actually having their property taken away. And what happens in this long process is that finally the commissioner gets to talk to the Margrave, and guess what's happened? All the Novus Christianus, the new Christians that he's supposed to be pursuing, hey, they've left town and they've taken whatever they need to take with them. And that was most of the relationship to power. In a way, that's also the relationship of a man like the appalling Gaspar Ducci. If you don't mind, I'm going to refer to him not as Ducci, which makes him sound Italian and respectable, but by what the English called him, which was Dauch, which I think is much more appropriate. Dauch came into Antwerp, again, connections. He came into Antwerp working for a trading house from Lucca in Italy. He was a junior member of that house. He was doing what a lot of bright young men did, come to Antwerp to work for a while and then see what you could make out of it. They didn't usually stay unless they happened to marry in Antwerp. Well, Dauch did marry in Antwerp, and he stayed. And slowly, by contacts and by thinking in this abstract way about money and about goods, he managed to make himself a real force in the Antwerp market. And in doing so, the emperor's people came to depend on him for money, and so did the King of France, even though the King of France and the emperor were at war at the time. And when we say that Ducci managed to corner the market in money, you have to remember that at this time, money supply was not something you worked out on an abacus or a computer. It was literal physical supply of money and coin. And if you suddenly got a block, a war, a battle, something like that, between you and the source of money, the money didn't arrive. And when that happened, that was catastrophic. Although most business was done on letters of credit, there was still an awful lot of stuff, the buying and selling of goods on the quayside, for example, that had to be done with cash. And Ducci literally cornered the market in cash. He treated cash like a commodity. And he cornered the market just as you might corner the market in, I don't know, wool or wine or gold or whatever you had to order. What an extraordinary change of mind that is. And he also went on to deal with every single power that he could. Now, it's true that the Hanseatic League before him had managed to deal with all sorts of powers around the North Sea without actually paying too much attention to their own local duties and alliances. But Ducci takes it much, much further. Ducci will lend to people who want him. Ducci will do so, and he will take as much power from that as possible. And slowly this power begins to grow and grow and grow. Each level feeds the next level, until Ducci becomes the man without whom nothing can happen in Antwerp. Now, if you're talking about a port where, I don't know, wool comes in from England, as it did, and you sell it to people who want wool to make cloth, as people did, then that's practical and ordinary. But when you're talking about people like Ducci, you're talking about a study in money that makes it possible to change the way you think about all sorts of things. And although it's rubbish to say that Antwerp is the cradle of capitalism and the cradle of shareholding and all the rest of it, it's not nonsense to say that Antwerp created, through these circumstances, the change of mind that makes those things possible.
In the sense of how cash is treated, like a commodity?
Yes, but also in the sense of thinking about things in terms of cash. If everything is in terms of deals, not in terms of... Look, I mean, it's like, it's possible. I mean, you may be more civilized than I am, but I have to say that thinking of a Van Gogh picture or seeing a reproduction, the first thing I remember is how much it sold for at Christie's last year. Now, do I think about the impasto? Do I think about the composition? Do I? Hell, I think about the figures. Thinking about things in money terms, making money a measure of value, is quite a new thing. It's also something that appears rather immoral in Christian terms. And Ducci's way of doing business just turns that on its head.
Well, that leads to a number of other topics with Antwerp. There's vice. There's also heresy, but we'll separate those two out since they're treated very differently politically. Governments, upstanding pious Christian governments, will have all sorts of tolerance for vice in ways they wouldn't for heresy. So let's talk about vice. The reputation of Antwerp as Babylon, does that have to do with its reputation for vice or heresy?
More.
Heresy, actually. Okay. It's the appalling Duke of Alba, a grumpy old aristocrat whose main interest in Antwerp was the money markets, actually. That was what he mostly did. Was sent to stomp on Antwerp as a nest of heretics. And he just looked around him and complained that actually Antwerp had heretics he hadn't even heard of, which is why he called it Europe's Babylon, the place where every kind of idea was tolerated and sometimes encouraged. Vice is an interesting and very complicated story, as far as I can see. Of course there was vice. Look, I mean, this is a big port in Europe. You know, guys are coming ashore after relatively long voyages, and they would like a little fun and a little respite. And of course there were people around to provide it. But there were also streets which were famous for not quite brothels, but houses of ill repute, let's say. And when new churches were built, sometimes there was the idea that a bit of the city could be cleaned up. But usually, for some reason, people found it really convenient to build the occasional house of ill repute on the way between two churches. It might tell us something about the people.
Hey, everyone. Scott here. One more brief word from our sponsors. So with Antwerp's reputation as vice, was it typical as a port city? Was there anything exceptional about it in that regard? Or was it exactly what you would expect from a historical perspective as a port city?
I think it's what you would expect, but arguably a bit more violent rather than a bit more sensual. I mean, this was a place where it could be given connections. Connections can also be wars. I mean, they can be deals. They can be wonderful nights out, but they can also be wars. And in many cases, of course, people who were at war were landing to sell to people they were in that war with, and guns got fired in the process.
I'm really curious about heresy, because in the 16th century, there's obviously the Protestant-Catholic divide, significant warfare that really isn't resolved until after the 30 Years' War, just incredibly violent period in Europe. But then there's all sorts of other things happening. You'll mention the William Tyndale Bible as well. And beyond the Catholic-Protestant divide, different types of confessional groups are springing up, what would be called heretical groups are springing up. So what did heresy mean at this time in history, and what different groups were present in Antwerp?
Well, it meant absolutely everything to Charles V, the emperor in Madrid. I mean, his extraordinary diaries, almost, that he wrote while he was traveling about Europe, are full of these obsessive things about it's time to smash heresy once and for all. His main obsession was Lutherans, but he was not at all keen on Jews. Antwerp had a completely different attitude, and it wasn't a particularly consistent one. I mean, this is not some liberal city. This is a city which has worked out that probably it shouldn't go after the people who were making its money. Take William Tyndale as an example. He was translating the Bible into English, and it was illegal to publish the Bible in English in England. But in Antwerp, he could get it printed, and he did get it printed. Within a year of printing his first edition of the New Testament in Antwerp, thanks to Antwerp, the same book, the whole print run, was burnt in the streets of Antwerp. Antwerp occasionally gave in to pressure from the empire to go after heretics, but mostly made things possible, and it made things more possible than anywhere else in Europe could manage. The basic truth is that Antwerp depended to a large extent on trade from southern Germany. Southern Germany was where the metals came from, the great mining areas. And that trade brought in heretics, Lutherans, left, right, and center. Lutherans, actually, rather than Calvinists, who arrive a little bit later, but eventually become so important that they take over the city. There were always, of course, the Novus Christianus, the new Christians, Jews coming usually from Portugal. So much so that you find in the notary records lots of Portuguese people who have come to Antwerp to stay and to work, who are swearing oaths they are not Jews, but they are honest Christians going through the world working honestly. Quite extraordinary. I mean, the association of the Portuguese and Jews was absolute. But it was also the place, of course, where you get a man like Damião de Goiás, who was head of the Casa de India, which was the Portuguese trading house for dealing with spices and everything that came from India, who will find himself at table with lots of Novus Christianus and will talk to them and will discover who they are and find out how they think, as presumably they also found out how he thought. He also came into contact with Lutherans there. And eventually you'll find this man who, remember, is the senior servant in Antwerp of the most Christian monarch, the most Christian king of Portugal, going off to hear Luther's sermons, having dinner with Luther and Melanchthon. It's quite extraordinary. Again, it's connections, connections, connections. It's difficult to see anywhere else in Europe that Damião de Goiás could so casually and so remarkably have talked to and begun to understand people of such very different attitudes. So you have on one level, you have Antwerp as the perfect Christian city. I mean, there are regular weekly processions of the sacraments in the streets. There's a wonderful, wonderful church. It's not quite yet a cathedral. It looks the perfect Catholic city, although Antwerp refused to have a bishop on the grounds that if you had a bishop, you'd just get the Inquisition within weeks, as indeed they did eventually. And so you keep the machinery of church power out as much as you possibly can. This was helped by the fact that every time anything went wrong in Antwerp, the canons of the cathedral church had a bad habit of bolting and going out of town, which meant they weren't even around to be persecuted, which may have been a rather clever move, actually. This is a city that looks perfectly Catholic, answering to an emperor who claims to be perfectly Catholic, but the people in it are anything but. So you not only get the printing of Calvinist texts at times, which do get punished, texts that were illegal in the countries they were designed for, like the English Bibles going to England. You also get the works of really obscure sects. That, further, there are Anabaptists, of course, people who don't believe that baptism has real value. There are also members of the Great Family of Love. Or in a way, this is a sect whose basic belief was you do what you are required to do. You go to Mass, you go to the processions of the sacraments, you bow the knee at the right moment, and you think whatever the hell you like. And that was the message. And in a sense, that was the message of Antwerp too.
How did they get away with it? Now, on the one hand, I can understand because, as you said, you have Charles V, the Holy Roman Emperor, who is incredibly pious, openly presents himself as the protector of the Holy Catholic Church, frequently goes to war with the Ottoman Empire, and he and Suleiman the Magnificent are the two great rivals of this time period. On the other hand, I can't imagine how difficult his job is trying to keep together an empire that is never closely united. He has Spanish Habsburg Empire to deal with. He has the Americas. His predecessor, Philip II, who was one of the most efficient monarchs in history, who fired off like 1,500 pieces of correspondence a month, is barely able to keep it together. Charles has something even more complicated to deal with. He has the Protestant Reformation going on. He's warring with France on one side. He's warring with the Ottomans on the other side. Was Antwerp able to get away with it just because Charles was so busy that he maybe couldn't deal with it or couldn't send agents, and also he didn't want to mess with the money or some other reason?
If you read the diplomatic letters from people around Charles, they very often say, we're all right this year because the emperor can't do anything because he's fighting the Turks or the Lutherans in Germany or whatever, so he can't possibly come here. And one of the political calculations that Antwerp and anybody in that situation was making is, can the emperor actually do anything? Can he get here? Remember how important it was in medieval times for the monarch to be physically present in a place. That was an important part of his authority. Now, if he couldn't do it for long periods of time, and everybody knew why he couldn't do it, and that he wasn't going to be able to arrive suddenly, like, you know, coming up through a trapdoor in a pantomime, then it's a lot less easy to defy Antwerp Antwerp finds it quite easy to defy him. And they were very careful. I mean, there are extraordinary things go on. Again, after Tyndale and the Bible in English, the English wanted Tyndale prosecuted. And for a time, the authorities were prepared to go with it, until Tyndale's lawyers pointed out, hang on a minute, why exactly are we prosecuting someone under the laws of England? When just at the moment, isn't the King of England trying to divorce a close relative of the Emperor of the Habsburg Empire? And finally, of course, the case gets dropped. It's an endless war of attrition. It's got much more to do with being cheeky, with thumbing your nose, really, at imperial power, but doing it carefully and doing all the important things properly.
One point you make is that the city nurtures a sort of a pragmatic kind of tolerance, and it rises quickly. It also disappears quickly. Why did it do this? What did Antwerp gain by potentially sticking its neck out on behalf of people like this, so-called heretics that were considered unsavory by different monarchs?
Because the heretics were the complete basis of its riches. The heretics
makes
were
sense.
And what's more, I mean, when assorted armies turn out of the walls of Antwerp and lay siege to Antwerp in 1542, you suddenly see that all of the heretic merchants come forward to defend the walls of Antwerp. This is extraordinary. Nobody really expected it to happen. But it meant that the heretics felt a sense of loyalty to the city, and the city reciprocated.
About how long did it keep up this balance?
I would reckon, in terms of its riches, from about 1502, which is when the first Portuguese ship lands with a load of spice, through to about 1556. And what happens in 1556 is an iconoclast. There's one night, one terrible night, when suddenly a gang of people, probably not more than 30 or 40 of them, invade the churches of Antwerp and smash them. And they smash the images, they smash the retables behind the altars, they smash anything that is not properly Protestant, which is, of course, the churches of Antwerp at the time. And when that happens, all of a sudden Madrid has to react, hasn't got any choice, because to a man like Charles V, or even more to his son, Philip II, there is this belief that if you challenge any kind of authority, the church's authority, for example, you're also challenging the authority of the empire, his authority. Everything is Les Majesty. So suddenly he has to send an army to stop this happening. He gets rid of the governor, very remarkable woman, whom he obviously thought was too weak to deal with things, and she goes into exile. And in comes an old-fashioned military ruler, despot is the word I really want to use, who wants to crush everything in sight. And that it's extraordinary how fragile this period was, how fragile this apparent tolerance, and how careful it was in many ways, because people went on as observant Catholics, whatever was happening. And even so, it's a remarkable period. The English have to say so. After all, we owe it probably the finest translation of the Bible into English, the great Tyndale Bible.
Before getting into this change in Antwerp, something I'm curious about is your research, because you had mentioned that the archives that typically would have been present of a city in the 16th century aren't here. So it took forensic work that would be different from studying, say, Renaissance era Venice or Pisa or Milan. So how did you piece together the different sources to try to put together this picture of Antwerp in the 16th century?
Well, I'm a foreigner in Antwerp. So I looked to what foreigners were saying about Antwerp. And it has huge advantages. And one of the things about going to foreign archives, going to the Medici in Florence, going to the various Protestant divines in Zurich, going to Venice, which was always reporting on Antwerp, one of the advantages is that these are people who had to explain things to an audience back home. So whereas you've got to do an enormous amount of work of analysis, which usually isn't possible in Antwerp because there just aren't the series of papers that you need for that. In the case of Antwerp, it was watched so closely by so many people for different reasons that they have to tell the people back home how things worked, what they looked like, what they smelt like and tasted like, what was possible and what was not. You also have an advantage, which is a quite sinister one, which is the Inquisition records in different places. Inquisition records in Venice in part, but also the Inquisition records in Lisbon. people who had been in Antwerp answered to the Inquisition and gave the most extraordinary circumstantial descriptions of what life was like in Antwerp. And I think what you can do from this is build up a sort of stereoscopic view of Antwerp. You have different viewpoints and you see what Antwerp's life was like. And I hope that's what the book is about.
You mentioned the fall of the city. So any other points that you want to mention there? And then how did Antwerp irrevocably change after it tried to rebel with the Dutch against the Spanish and lost? So what happened?
Well, just one point. It's important to say that after the Iconoclasm in 1556, things go wrong. They go wrong in many different ways. And you suddenly get painters writing to people saying, well, I'm not going to stay in Antwerp any longer because I can't work here. I can't sell here. I can't do business here. So I'm going. You get even Spanish merchants in the Spanish Netherlands saying that they're going to sell all their ships and take their capital home to Spain because they just can't do business in Antwerp anymore. So things get disrupted. This strange, wonderful, magical almost peace in the streets goes completely wrong. And all of a sudden you have a very familiar offshoot of the Reformation struggles. You have a Catholic power trying to suppress Protestants and other heretics. That's a process that goes on for a long time. In the end, after the Spanish burn the city, remember the Spanish had no great love for Antwerp, you can tell that, because when they finally got round to building a citadel in Antwerp, it's so far upriver that any enemy fleet coming to attack Antwerp would have sailed past most of the walls before anybody could actually lob a cannonball in the general direction of a ship. And what's more, when the citadel was being built, the first two bastions with guns that were put up don't look out to the river. They don't look out over the walls. They look into the city itself. It was always designed to control the city. Well, if you've got a city which is both disrupted by violence, by mutinous troops, by the prospect of fire, and also disrupted because the general processes of trade are going wrong, and when you realize that everybody's method for attacking Antwerp became blockading the river, knowing perfectly well that if you could blockade the Scheldt, you could ruin Antwerp, because if the ships could not come in and go out, there was nothing to be done. All of that went wrong over quite a long period. So it's a very sad period of decline, until finally you get, in the 1600s, an English diplomat who comes to Antwerp and says that he and his people have gone around the whole town. He does not think he has seen 4 pence worth of business done. He sees grass growing on the streets. And those are streets where the carts used to break down the cobblestones so often, and nothing could possibly grow. The town dies slowly.
So it's rolled up into the Habsburg Empire. And what would you say is the legacy of Antwerp, even though there's not sort of an unbroken story that's passed on in the forthcoming centuries? So how would you describe its legacy, even if it is largely forgotten?
Well, the legacy, in a way, there is a continuous legacy. It's the printing traditions of Amsterdam, which fed off the printing traditions of Antwerp. It's the art market of Amsterdam, which fed off the art market of Antwerp. And the production of pictures, by the way, for people's homes, not for people's chapels or people's palaces, but people's homes, for the alcove in the corner. It's the business of thinking in money terms, which eventually, of course, produces the ability to take the shipping companies that become the Dutch VOC, the East Indies Company, ram them together into a single company and sell shares in it. You can think in that abstract fashion about the business of doing trade to the Far East and bringing back spices. All of these things are continuous. What we miss, I think, is the extent to which the glories of Antwerp's golden age depended on the glories of Antwerp's glory years.
All right. Well, I think this should give people pause, not only in re-understanding the 16th century and the city's role in it, but the modern day understanding of Antwerp, as you mentioned, cocaine use and people wearing Crocs. So there's a lot for many people here to chew on. Well, I love revisionist accounts like this. And for listeners who want to explore the story more, the name of your book is Europe's Babylon, The Rise and Fall of Antwerp's Golden Age. Michael, thank you for joining us.
God, thank you very much indeed. That was a pleasure.
All right, so that is all for the episode today. Once again, I want to start things off by thanking the Spymasters of History Unplugged. I'll explain what that is in a second. Our Spymasters include Bill Ivey, Moondoggy from Ohio, Tom from Ohio, Ryan Gillen, Rob from Chicago, Nick Brooks, Michael from New York, Carl from Norway, Josh Reddick, Jennifer French Lee, Jay Carrington, McCrays, Salvador Sanchez, David Santee, Chris C., and Baron Fraser. If you'd like to support the show, there's some very easy ways to do so. First, go to the site halfpricehistory.com. I've worked out an arrangement with a lot of the authors who've appeared on this show, and you can go there and get their books for 50% off. All you have to do is go to halfpricehistory.com and enter the promo code UNPLUGGED at checkout. Second, please leave a review and subscribe to this podcast on your favorite podcast player of choice, whether Apple Podcasts or Spotify or Stitcher or whatever. Third, join our Facebook group. You can go to Facebook and search for History Unplugged. There, you can talk with other fans of the show about recent episodes, what you liked, what you didn't like. Also, I have exclusive content there, such as live streams, where I do live versions of podcast episodes, where you can leave feedback as I'm talking, and I will address it on air. Last, and I think this is the best, is to join our membership program, the Knowlton's Rangers. The Knowlton's Rangers were George Washington's spies during the Revolutionary War, but it's also the name of the membership program for History Unplugged. If you go to patreon.com/unplugged, you can join the membership program at three levels. If you join at the Scout level, you'll get all 400 episodes of History Unplugged absolutely ad-free and early access to new episodes. If you join at the second level, the Intelligence Officer level, get all the stuff that Scouts get, along with bonus episodes. There's currently about 40 of them, including series on Audie Murphy and Operation Long Jump about the Nazi attempt to assassinate FDR, Churchill, and Stalin in 1943. Finally, if you join at the Spymaster level, you'll get a shout out to you and or your business at the end of each episode. You get a 3-pack of hardcover history books, and you can find out what those are if you go to patreon.com/unplugged. Finally, you can ask me a question about history on absolutely any topic on earth, and I will research it and devote an entire episode to your question. Probably about 30% of the questions in the archive for the show have been based on these sorts of questions. So there you go. Go to patreon.com/unplugged to learn more. All right, well, that is all for today's episode. Thank you so much for listening, and I'll see you next time.